There are dozens of different methods when it comes to military mobility. That's getting our troops from point A to point B, whether in combat or whether scouting areas with their next venture. For years, military members and infantry service members have walked with their rucksacks. They've used trucks, they've used tanks, many different ways to get the job done. Our guest today on Tartan Talks is Angela Ambrose, the VP of Government Relations and Communications for GM Defense, a subsidiary of General Motors, which was awarded the production contract to build and sustain the Army's new infantry squad vehicle. She joined us today to talk about what this means to be part of such an important project, what exactly this vehicle is going to look like and act like in the field, and how it's going to benefit our military men and women. She also talks about her career, from an internship in Washington, D.C., through the Department of Defense, through working with GM, and through other private enterprises. She also reflected on her time as an Edinburgh University student, where she was heavily involved in the State Systems Board of Governors and in our own Student Government Association. So join us as we listen to Angela Ambrose from GM Defense. For our gearheads out there, for our military members, and for people that are just curious, this is definitely an episode for you. This is Tartan Talks, a podcast from Edinburgh University. I'm your host, Christopher LaFuria. Each month, we'll take a look at individuals who make Edinburgh an exciting, diverse, and profound place to discover your passions. All right, well, we have a very special episode of Tartan Talks today. I know I say that a lot. Every episode is special, but this particular episode just appeals to so many audiences. We're going to be talking about vehicles to relate to the gearheads. We're going to be talking about the military and their relationships with these private companies. And we're going to talk once again about communications. We have here Angela Ambrose, who's the Vice President of Government Relations and Communications with GM Defense, which is a subsidiary of General Motors. She's also a 2002 graduate of Edinburgh. She's going to talk about her path from Edinburgh through her internship in Washington, D.C., and she's going to talk about a lot of her communications with a new, exciting vehicle that GM Defense is launching for the Army Infantry. So thank you, Angela, so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you here on Tartan Talks.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here to talk to you today.
All right, so what I really want to talk about, and this is going to get gearheads everywhere excited. Recently, I believe in 2019, GM got a contract for $214 million to produce an infantry squad vehicle for the United States Army. What happened is GM gets the contract, they create an ISV, the infantry squad vehicle, and it's one of those, it's a vehicle that transports troops, can be loaded onto helicopters, and it is just an exciting piece of mobility technology from the Army. Take us through the creation of this vehicle. Take us through the specifications. Tell us what's exciting about this project for you.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think what's so exciting at General Motors is that we're back in the defense business. We took a little bit of a hiatus back in the early 2000s and actually sold off our defense business to General Dynamics. In 2017, we decided it made a lot of sense for what we were doing in the commercial industry to see if we could pull that thread and offer better technology and more capabilities to the Department of Defense again. The infantry squad vehicle, as you mentioned, is based off of the 2020 Chevrolet Colorado, which is our mid-sized truck, and has been super successful in a lot of different venues on the commercial side, including the Desert Racing Series. When the Army said that they needed a transporter for an infantry squad, which is 9 soldiers, we thought we could take a very capable, agile truck and reconfigure it to meet the requirements that the Army obviously had to move soldiers from point A to point B. And so we really put our heads together to take the chassis of that truck, the frame of that truck, build it out, and then reconfigure the seating assignments to get the 9 guys in, get their rucks on board, and get them going quickly, where they would normally have to walk or march in the back in the olden days when we talked about the Army. Now they have the ability to hop on an infantry squad vehicle and get somewhere faster and get to the mission quicker as well.
Yeah, and it's pretty exciting not only to see a private company like GM work with the government to create this, but also it's something that kind of expands on GM's reputation of creating these trucks. And like you said, it's not something that was technically built from the ground up. But you've taken the 2020 Chevy Colorado,
a normal passenger vehicle used on work sites, used for family transportation, and you basically souped it up to be an infantry service vehicle to carry troops around. And I think that's just pretty neat project that you're working together to create something for the military. So talk a little bit to our gearhead audience, our car nuts, people that are obsessed with trucks. What makes this vehicle, this project, so exciting as far as creating this vehicle? Give us some specifications. Talk about its versatility, all that kind of stuff. We want to know the good stuff behind this without giving too much of it away.
Sure. Well, I think the most important thing that gearheads love about this vehicle is that it's 90% commercial off the shelf. So what does that actually mean? The government has rated this vehicle commercial parts available. They're not all GM parts, but the majority of them obviously are. We take a traditional chassis out of a Chevy Colorado, we take that frame and we militarize it. But we like to say from the waist down, it's a Chevy Colorado, and anyone can go into any dealership that sells performance racing parts and pick up the dampers and look at what tires we're using and check out the engine, all of these amazing capabilities that we can bring forward, but we can also offer into the commercial space. I think the only thing that's probably purpose-built that they might not be able to pick up at your local dealership is the rollover protection system. That's obviously very important when you look at the infantry squad vehicle. What would traditionally be the bed of the truck now holds four outward bound and rear facing soldiers with four seats. So we need to make sure that those guys are also protected. And what the rollover protection system does is it allows the vehicle to get into the back of a helo, be air deployable, get dropped to the ground, and with something as simple as a pin, which is custom made and pretty impressive technology in its own feet, throw up that rollover protection system to protect those in the back of the vehicle, throw the pin in and go. So again, it's 90% commercial off the shelf with all of the gearheads excited about things that they could buy, procure, put on their own vehicle, basically build this thing in their backyard if they feel like it, and then get to understand what is that rollover protection system for those in the full back of the vehicle.
And I think that's what makes this project so interesting is because, like you said, it's 90% commercial vehicle, but also this isn't necessarily just a vehicle that you can use around forts and bases. This is something that can actually be taken into combat. It can be sling loaded into a Black Hawk and fit inside a Chinook. Talk about that from a GM standpoint. You're seeing vehicles that could be used, you know, to carry our troops into combat. They can be used around the globe. What does that mean to you, and what does that mean to GM?
Well, I think for an American company, it's amazing to get back in and support the warfighter. That's definitely part of our mission set. But we also have a global supply line. You know, we are not just in the US, we have dealerships across the world. So when you think about things that are purpose-built for the military, which are necessary and needed, and of course, all of us in the contractor space are answering what requirements that the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines might put out, the supply line of us getting what they may need inbound in theater is so much faster and more robust because this supply line is, you know, so huge.
Right.
And when you look at GM as a global manufacturer, when we came in from the defense angle to, I would say, the parent company and said, this is an opportunity that we believe we have a right to win, and we believe we've got the right offering for the Army. And they said, how many vehicles is it? And we said, the totality of the program is a little over 2,000 vehicles. And the response was, in a day, in a week, in a month, how fast do you need those? And our response was, over the lifespan of the vehicle, right? So while we think that those numbers will likely increase, and there are other variants that we are working on, you know, Marines don't necessarily need a 9-passenger vehicle, special operations don't necessarily need a 9-passenger vehicle. When you look at other pieces inside of the Army, other components, I should say, they may need, instead of having soldiers in the back, they may need to have a gun ring, a gun mount. They may need to have the truck version where they can bring other things along with a traditional ISV. So looking at variants and what we can offer, but how we can manufacture and how we can stand up a manufacturing line. To us at GM, this is a very low production. Currently, the first offering, you mentioned the $214 million contract, that's only the first 600 plus vehicles with the ability to flex up to a little over 1,000 vehicles. And then the follow-on for the program is, like I said, up to that 2,000 vehicles. But there's an ability for this to get to tens of thousands of vehicles. And there is the ability that we may sell them internationally and support some of our allies as well.
So what has it been like, I guess, from the implementation, I guess, of the design phase through the implementation, through all the engineering and also the field testing, kind of working with the Army, working with GM to find out, you know, how we can make this vehicle optimal. Talk about that process of working across the private to public lines to kind of see what you can do to make this the best vehicle possible.
Yeah, I think that's probably my favorite question. And the reason for that is, I think more so than anyone competing for this vehicle, GM really heard what the soldiers said during vehicle testing. And we implemented those changes from the first testing series to the second testing series. We took into account, and I put this in quotes, our customer. Our customer is the soldier here. But on the commercial space, it's every consumer that drives these vehicles. So having the right seats, having the right seat belts and harnesses, making sure that the outboard facing soldiers have the right shelf to put their feet on and have a grip so that their boots don't slide off if it's raining. Those kinds of small little things that other companies are taking for granted were front of mind for General Motors. We really wanted to make sure that it drove like a Colorado. The soldiers felt comfortable in this vehicle, and really we helped them with what we would consider fatigue, right? I mean, you're marching from point A to point B, or you're riding in a vehicle where, you know, your feet are falling off, or, you know, you've got to have a seatbelt that doesn't really secure you the right way. You're holding your ruck. It's not really in a compartment space where it's protected as well. And that doesn't really work. And right. In this environment, we can offer a better product if we're offering it to our consumers. Why don't our soldiers deserve the same thing? And in GM's mind, they absolutely do. And that's the truck that we offered them.
And also, correct me if I'm wrong, but since it is 90% of Chevy Colorado, most soldiers that might have a background in mechanics would be able to make repairs if something like this happened, because GM parts are some of the most widely available. So if something were to happen to this, this isn't something very technical that you need a specialized mechanic to come in. This is something that with a baseline knowledge of, you know, mechanics, you can come in and make, you know, adjustments or fix on the go if you needed to. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. And, you know, traditionally in these kinds of procurements, there are technical data packages that we then provide. What we would pull out of our glove box and be like, why is this on my dashboard? Right. I don't understand this light. We need to make sure that in theater, downrange, wherever these soldiers are around the world, they have the capability in front of them. And so we've taken it very seriously that we're providing manuals to them so that it reads like it would if you were, again, kind of working in your garage or working in your backyard, that some of these gearheads can absolutely get into this vehicle and fix it on the go. And it shouldn't be anything too crazy that they haven't been able to do in previous worlds.
Yeah, because in certain situations, like you said, in theater, like seconds, minutes matter. So if you're able to make adjustments to a vehicle right then and there, that could be the difference of, you know, an advantage, or even to the point of saving lives if you can get in and out and make a quick fix. I've read through some of the statistics about it. 186 horsepower, 2.8 liter Duramax turbo diesel engine, and a 6-speed auto transmission. And what it says, and you mentioned earlier, it's been proven in some of the most grueling desert race series. Unless you're actually in combat or using it on the field, it's kind of tough to see how it would be used literally in the field. So how are you able to replicate these scenarios? You're able to test and see how these vehicles adapt. And like you said, you talked with the soldiers about what adjustments you can make. Take us through like the testing process to see how you're making this the most optimal vehicle.
Sure. Well, through the contract award process, there are required testing milestones. And so you need to hit that milestone to then get down selected to continue to move forward in the contracting process. So we tested in Aberdeen, and then we tested at Fort Bragg. And we had, like I mentioned, those soldier touch points and the feedback. You know, they really tried to break the truck. And in some instances, they tried and nearly succeeded. As the contractor, you know, you have limited time to kind of fix it for the next day of testing. So, you know, that's kind of been how we've moved that forward. But on the kind of on the flip side, on the commercial side, you know, we've got, I mean, I couldn't even put it, I'm sure someone else smarter than me that works on the Chevy team could tell you, but the amount of hours that are tested on our Colorado, and then you look at the Chad Hall racing truck, which is the performance parts put on that Colorado. And so you can see the progression. There's the Colorado, there's the racing variant of this vehicle, and now there's the ISV. So It was great. We were at our Milford Proving Ground not that long ago, and we had the Chad Hall Racing Truck, we had the Colorado, and we had an ISV. You know, I wanted to do some photography and some videography, and we talked about that a little bit offline, but really seeing how these vehicles, the three of them stacked up beside each other, is pretty incredible because they go from your traditional walk into a dealership, buy a truck, to souped up with the performance variants. This truck, the actual Chad Hall Racing Truck, he let us borrow it for the photo shoot, but getting that from California, seeing how it can take a curve. We are, you know, jumping it, we're taking it over ruts. Our proving ground is huge in Michigan, and seeing how those two vehicles perform and then putting the ISV beside it and watching them take off was something pretty incredible, because you can really pull that thread.
Yeah, definitely. So as the government relations and communications specialist and the vice president, you're seeing all these processes come together. You're seeing the development of these vehicles and also the promotion of them. How does it feel as an employee or somebody that's so invested in this project to see this move forward from a concept to a contract award to field testing and eventually in the field itself? Take us through what that feels like to know that's going on.
Yeah, it's incredible. Not only is it incredible for me personally, I came to DC and very quickly knew I really wanted to get into the defense policy space, and I wanted to work in national security. My sister just recently retired as a Navy captain, so she was on a ship out at sea, and I was working on Capitol Hill in Congress, and we would be talking back and forth about things that I could do in DC that was supporting her wherever she was around the world. And I knew that defense was really important to me. So my whole career has really taken off from Capitol Hill and then into the government space as a civilian, federal civilian, and then out into the private sector. But it's all been in national security. And so coming to GM for this specific role, as we're reinstating a defense practice, as we're getting back into the defense business, bringing commercial technology to the warfighter, personally, it's exactly what I'm passionate about and absolutely why I'm here. But what gives me even more appreciation for the company that I work for is when you take the CEO, Mary Barra, and she kicks the tires of the infantry squad vehicle. When you look at Mark Royce, the GM president, all of GM, not just GM defense, right?
The entire GM.
He jumps the truck and takes it all around the proving ground. He's driving it. At the senior most levels at GM, we have the support of this company to get back in and help our warfighters and show them that we will bring amazing technology to them. And as we advance our technology in the commercial space, you know, outside of traditional engines, as we continue to move in electric vehicles, fuel cell technology, et cetera, it is our mission to bring that forward to the warfighter, regardless of the service, but certainly support the Department of Defense and then other government agencies as well. So personally, I'm passionate about it, but I'm really proud to be a part of a team that believes so much in it as well.
Yeah, and this personal passion that you're experiencing, this isn't something that people can take lightly too. There are severe, significant implications for this too. You're creating a military vehicle that's going to be used by infantrymen and women across the globe. So not only is it something that you can sit back and say, wow, the CEO of GM is impressed with our work, this is something that's going to save lives. This is something that's going to help the soldiers in combat. So I think that's an extra layer of satisfaction that would come with a project just like this.
Absolutely. I think one thing we haven't mentioned is we delivered, once we were awarded the contract from the Army, it took GM 120 days, 4 months, to deliver the first vehicles to the Army. That's unheard of.
Yeah.
90% commercial off the shelf. Obviously, we need to build two requirements. So we are stripping it down and making sure it's the vehicle that the Army needs and that we've shared we're going to deliver. But in 120 days, we were able to deliver our first vehicles. So we're agile and we want to be supportive and we want to move fast. And we had a milestone event to kind of celebrate the engineers that have brought this vehicle forward and invited our Army customer to attend that event. We got some great press coverage, so we're thankful for that. Yeah. But it's less about the good news that GM's back in the business and much more about the product that we're delivering and making sure that the Army feels like this is the best version of an infantry squad vehicle. You know, we call it a better boot. I say that a lot when I'm talking to comms folks, because it is. You know, you don't have to have men and women on infantry teams, you know, marching anymore. They can hop into these vehicles and get somewhere fast and get on mission quicker. And I'm just I'm so excited to be a part of the program, and I'm so proud that GM Defense has been able to deliver as quickly as we have, and I know we're going to continue to do so.
So yeah, this isn't something that's necessarily replacing any current military vehicles. They still have like their normal transportation, their tanks, their helicopters. This is something that is completely an addition, a support for people, like you said earlier, that these infantrymen and women are basically going to be marching and walking. So this is going to take the place of that, help them to get from point A to B quicker. And you're talking about marching with 100 to 150 pound rucksacks. So being able to have that. And also, I like how you talked about you can adjust these trucks too. So if they need a gunner in the back or if they need to make adjustments, that's something that can come along with that too. So where do you see, I guess, this project going from here? I know it's a little premature to guess that or to predict that because you're just rolling out the vehicles and getting everything settled, but what are some of the next steps for the GM defense team?
Well, for the infantry squad vehicle in particular, we are moving to full rate production here shortly. We're at low rate production now, and that's obviously a much smaller amount of vehicles that we're producing. We're moving our facility to Concord, North Carolina. So we're building out that facility. We're breaking ground next month, which is exciting. I was just in North Carolina last week getting to see what that facility looks like and how it will support the program. So we'll ramp up to full rate production in the early spring. And I believe that, you know, our conversations with the Army and the customer intimacy we have there is only going to grow. I think that we're going to see certainly a growth in the number of infantry squad vehicles that the Army has kind of planned for since they are a successful addition. And as you mentioned, this is something new. It's not in the mobility arsenal right now, and there's certainly an ability to support a larger amount of infantry squads. But what else is next for us? Kind of what's in our pipeline? We look at, you know, everything that's coming out from the department, but we really categorize things in integrated vehicles. So commercial derivative models of vehicles. So we're looking at where else we could fit in that mobility space of traditional vehicles, which makes sense for GM. So integrated vehicles, then we look at power and propulsion systems. And that's if you think, if it's not a vehicle, if we're not actually building the truck, what could we be building? And so I would say, you know, as an example, we're doing an electric ground power unit. You think about all of the generators on all of the flight lines that are loud and toxic and need a fuel. And you think about converting that to an electric generator and how clean it is, how quiet it is. And while folks go off on their flight, it gets recharged for the next flight line when they need to do it. So looking at things like that, where we can take commercial technology out of a vehicle in a power and propulsion sense and move it forward. We're also doing that on unmanned underwater vehicles,
wow,
putting either batteries or our fuel cell technology in some of those programs. And then I would say mobility and autonomy is the third bucket for us of our capabilities. So how do we increase military mobility? Where are there areas where we can support? The government has a tendency to buy a vehicle and then maintain that vehicle. The commercial industry makes a vehicle, and then inherently there will be upgrades to that vehicle.
Yes.
2020 is not the same as a 2015. Are they both great vehicles? Absolutely. Is one likely more capable and has advanced technologies? Absolutely. And so we want them to kind of take that mindset in. And, you know, autonomy is where the future is going. You know, we'd like to take the warfighter out of harm's way where possible. And we think given what we're doing on the commercial space in autonomy, we can certainly be supportive there as well. So GM Defense is looking in those three buckets: integrated vehicles, power propulsion, and mobility and autonomy. There are some pretty giant pursuits in our pipeline, one of which is the Joint Light Tactical Vehicle. There is an incumbent. There are a lot of those vehicles currently in the fleet, but the Army is rebuilding that program, and we are certainly looking at what that could be for GM Defense. And there's a couple of other things I can't necessarily share too publicly quite yet. But
trade secrets, of course.
Yeah, we don't like to always tip our hats to our competitors to let them know we're going to compete, but we've been pretty vocal about the Joint Light Tactical Vehicle, that we've got a real interest there, and we think that our capabilities will actually support the Army in a way that they're not being supported currently.
I know we've talked a lot about the successes and a lot of the exciting moments. What are some of the hiccups or some of the struggles that you've seen from the GM Defense implementation a few years ago to the rollout of this ISV? What are some of the hiccups that you've kind of had to go through in this process?
Well, I think for me, because I'm a defense girl by nature, I'm coming into an automotive company to do defense. Mm-hmm. So we, those in the defense team, are saying, this is how our customer, whoever it is inside of the service space at the Department of Defense or the government, this is how they procure vehicles. In the commercial space, you're in charge of all of that. You're in charge of the timeline. You're in charge of the dollar amount. You're in charge of the technology. That isn't how it works in our craft. So we are really having those internal conversations all the time. We've got a reach back capability where we go to GM engineers, or we go into GM manufacturing, or we go into GM legal. There's a lot of reach back that we have to our parent company, because we are considered technically in the GM world a startup, which sounds crazy because we have General Motors in our name. But we're meant to be small, agile, and kind of forward thinking. You know, we're taking some pretty big risks, I would say, that are not traditional to, GM takes risks, but not traditional in the space that I'm working in.
Right.
So, you know, that can cause a little bit of conflict, but the good news is, and as I said a little bit ago, you know, we definitely have the support of the senior most leadership. We have the support of those, not only on the senior leadership team for large GM, but for the board of managers for GM Defense. And we've got the right folks supporting us. So we're certainly all in, and we've got a pretty hefty pipeline in front of us, and we're going to be making some pretty awesome announcements soon.
That's encouraging. And it's also nice to see that even if you do have little bumps in the road, there aren't not anything that can completely throw off a project, or there are things that you can quickly solve, because it sounds like you have a pretty good team established, and you have under the umbrella of GM, it sounds like everything can be figured out if you need to just put the right people on it. So you talked a little bit about how you have worked in defense, working with GM as well. Take us through that career path. You graduated from Edinburgh University in 2002. What brought you to the DC area, and how did you develop a career where you've been on Capitol Hill, you've been traveling around the country working with GM? Take us through your career history.
Sure. So I was obviously at Edinburgh, and at the time I was student government president, and that gave me the opportunity while still a student to apply to serve on, at the time, the State System of Higher Education's Board of Governors. So the 20-person board with the chancellor that are overseeing the state system schools. And luckily I was asked to join that board. So I served on the board in Harrisburg my junior and senior year in college. And to be honest, it took a lot of time. So I was in Harrisburg quite a bit, and heading out from the Erie Airport felt like every other week. The thing that was amazing is I got to know some of the folks from the governor's staff, and they said, you know, you need to really think about what you want to do next. And I had a communications degree. I was working towards it. I really always thought I'd probably get into, you know, advertising and marketing. That's where I felt like I talk a lot and I write a lot, and I felt like that's where I would move. But then I served on this board, and I got to see, at least at the state level, what politics was really about. And sure, you know, I was the president of student government, and sure, I was the president of my sorority, and, you know, did all of these other kinds of extracurriculars, but I didn't really understand how politics worked. At the end of my internship working for the, or I got an internship with the governor. And at the end of my internship, when I graduated, they said, you know, we'd love to offer you a job. You can move to Harrisburg, or you can move to Washington. You can continue to be an intern, because we're shutting down that office. So here in DC, there's a building which is, which all governor's offices in town, whether they're Republican or a Democrat, they kind of all are housed in one group together by the Capitol. And Governor Ridge had just left Pennsylvania and was coming to DC to begin and be the first secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, a huge job. And I thought, man, that sounds like something I want to learn a little bit more about. 9/11 had happened. I wanted to be a steward of the people. I wanted to continue this work. So I moved to DC and did a lot of cow chopping, because I didn't have a real job, making a couple bucks an hour as an intern. And actually reached out to someone through the chancellor's office that was the president of Clarion when I was the president of Edinburgh in the student government world, and said, hey, heard you got married. Congratulations. You haven't seen me in 2 years. Awesome. I'm not on Facebook. Quick question. I need a job. And he worked in the House of Representatives for a member from Pennsylvania and said, we actually have an opening. So I went over and I interviewed, and luckily got the job. And I served for that congressman for about 5 years. He was a senior member of the House Appropriations Committee, which is how I originally got into the defense side of things and understanding the government funding. But he also had Penn State in his district, and Penn State has an applied research lab for the Navy working with the Office of Naval Research, which is how I got my first clearance. And when the congressman announced that he was retiring, it was kind of, do you want to stay on the Hill and be a political person? Or are you driven by the policy side? And I had to really think about that, and I'm driven by the policy. When the opportunity came up, there was a few jobs on the table since he was retiring, and it was kind of time for me to move on. And I'm very, very fortunate to say I got to go and work on the joint staff and work in counter-improvised explosive devices and really be a part of the effort that was protecting our men and women downrange. And the kind of steps from there led into the intelligence community as a civilian as well, working for the Director of National Intelligence before I came into the private sector. And I've kind of been one of those people that wants to check boxes. Mm-hmm. I checked the box, I worked on the Hill, got it. I checked the box, I worked at DOD, got it. I should probably understand the intelligence community from the inside, check the box, got it. Once you get to a certain place around the halls here in DC, people come a-knocking, and it made a lot of sense to go to a defense prime to understand how the business side worked. So I went to Northrop Grumman and was kind of their chief budget liaison and congressional strategist working in aerospace. I got a little bit, I feel like I got a little bit bartered in a back office deal. The head of government relations at Northrop served on a board with the president of a company called Accenture and their federal practice. And he said, I need a defense lobbyist. And she said, well, I know this great girl. She's here. She's not really on my team. She's in the aerospace sector. Maybe this could be a good transition. And I said, am I getting fired? I'm confused at what's happening here. But it was great because I was at a defense prime, and now I got to understand, you know, much more about the technology side. You know, there was a parent company that was international, so I understood more from the security side as to how we did defense work and made sure we didn't have, you know, foreign ownership, any control on that space. So what do firewalls really mean inside of a company?
Yeah.
And then this opportunity came up, and it was the ability for me to get back to my roots and do comms as well as government relations and be at the beginning stages of a company as they redevelop and determine what their pipeline is going to be. So it's been a lot of different boxes checked, but I'm pretty happy with the box I sit in currently.
Now, did you, when you were graduating from Edinburgh and working in Harrisburg and eventually DC, did you see yourself working in infantry squad vehicles and military mobility?
I could have never imagined it. My oldest sister had been in the military, and she had been in ROTC. And so I saw her kind of steps into the Navy, and that was interesting to me, but it wasn't a path for me necessarily. But my parents were both teachers, and, you know, my mother worked at the School for Blind Children in Oakland and Pittsburgh. My dad worked for the inner city public schools. I had done all of the stuff at a state system school. So I just assumed I would come to DC and work in education policy at the federal level. And it was probably my first 6 months working on Capitol Hill where I thought, yeah, that's actually not where my interests lie. Like, I support the education system, and I support public schools, and I'm very much in support of, you know, what the universities are doing back home. But for me personally, there's a passion here. There's a war going on inside of the Beltway of DC and all around the world. And this is the war that I can support. I can actually do things here that help people somewhere else. And I want to do that. And that's how the path started.
Interesting. And it sounds like you've been involved in so many different projects, so many different angles. So from a communications and a government relations standpoint, or just from being able to check all those boxes, what has kept your momentum? What has been driving you to is it out of like just you're personally driven, or you had things you wanted to accomplish? What has gotten you from Edinburgh to be able to check all those boxes and continue to, you know, develop your career and also to make an incredible impact to something like GM Defense?
I would definitely say that Edinburgh provided me a concrete foundation to envision what I could be. And when I came to DC, I hadn't been to DC since I was an 18-year-old kid on a high school field trip. So I just kind of packed my car and showed up and, like I said, kind of couch hopped for a little while until it worked out. I'm a pretty driven person and I have very, very specific milestones that I think are important to hit. And so once I started to kind of pace out where I wanted to be, it was really important to me to hit them. But I really believe that I wouldn't have been here if I'd gone to other universities and I had different experiences than what Edinburgh offered to me. I don't know that this is where I would be. And so I'm very grateful to my time and certainly to the communications professors that I had that really could see in me something that I maybe didn't even see in myself. And certainly those on the Board of Governors helped me in that sense as well. But, you know, I don't know that I would have a master's degree in national security if I didn't have that communications degree in communications, because I don't know that I would have thought in that way. So it's been great milestones to kind of hit along the path, but certainly I think I'm pretty driven.
Yeah.
It's been a good road.
Yeah,
pretty
definitely.
Good journey.
So what are some, without giving away too much from GM Defense, what are some of your next big projects you're going to be working on personally in your office?
Yeah, the Joint Light Tactical Vehicle is kind of the next thing in front of us. We really have a year to influence that next program. We anticipate the request for proposal coming out from the military in a year from January. So for me and my team, that is, you know, heads down, making sure that we're doing everything we can in the press side of things, the media side of things, and then also on the flip side, working our relationships on Capitol Hill to let them know what our capabilities are and why we think we're the ones that should be selected for that contract. That's really the biggest thing in front of us. We've got a couple of other things you'll see an announcement probably in January. So I'll hold on that. And I'll just share that I'm involved in a very big way. And we'll talk more about it in a bit. But there's some very interesting things outside of defense that we're in support of. And, you know, really keeping the infantry squad vehicle sold is very important to us.
Yeah, definitely.
Expanding what those options could be, those variants could be. Do our foreign partners and foreign militaries need this kind of capability? Can we ensure that we're getting them the best thing we can? And, you know, there's a lot of souped up Suburbans you see rolling around. So I anticipate we'll continue to play in that market as well.
So one thing I've been wanting to ask you since we started, have you gotten a chance to drive the ISV yet?
Yeah, I have. It's awesome. We had a couple of photographers and videographers out to do some stuff for us. And we actually had Motor Trend gave them an exclusive on the vehicle. So had the reporter out to drive the vehicle as well. I mean, it drives like a Colorado, right?
Sure,
so
yeah.
It's pretty awesome. It's a little bumpier and it's real cold in Michigan. So you got to kind of barrel down. I made the ultimate mistake of hopping in the passenger seat with my chief engineer, who is also a race car driver.
Oh, geez.
Talk about a gearhead, right? And we were going kind of from the site where we're building low rate production to our military course, which is our military course, like a mile or so, 2 miles away, but still in the same complex. And he took off like a bat out of hell. And I thought, oh, this is what it's going to be like for whoever's sitting in the passenger seat and, you know, kicking up rocks and dirt all over the place. And just, he, you know, for him, this is his day job. So
Oh, yeah. Real
fun. For me, it's like, well, I was driving it a little bit more delicately around the track the other day,
like,
and
consumer,
now I popped
yeah.
it. Yeah, exactly. And Mark, he really wanted to have some fun. So it's pretty awesome.
That's awesome. Well, I mean, it's been great talking to you, getting to know about the ISV and everything that GM Defense is doing with the military. So Angela Ambrose, 2002 graduate of Edinburgh and the Vice President of Government Relations and Communications with GM Defense. It was a pleasure talking to you today, and we'll have to keep our Tartan Talks listeners in tune to what's going on in January and the future for you. So thank you so much for joining us today. It's been wonderful getting to know you and getting to know your projects.
Thank you so much. It's been great to talk to you.